Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
My guest today is Michael Fierstack, a well-respected, sophisticated, and possibly even underrated singer, songwriter, and musician based in Montreal. For many years, Mike played in an Ottawa-based band called the Wooden Stars and also nurtured his own project, Snail House. Well, last year, Mike released an LP called Tambourine Deathbed. It's the first record he ever released under his own name. And he's already set to put out a new collaborative record on April 19th. It's called Singer Songer. And he's also scheduled to play Kazoo Fest in Guelph between April 9th and 13th. And I'm sure Mike will have more tour dates to follow. Mike and I spoke in the fall of 2013, and I just had not had a chance to share this with the world. As it turns out, the timing right now is perfect. Announcement about a new record, which we actually talked about. I learned about this record, Singer Songer, in the fall, but as I say, just hadn't had a chance to share it yet. Here it is, myself and Mike. Mike's a very smart, funny, thoughtful guy. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. You're also going to hear a song from Mike's last record, Tambourine Deathbed, on the show. And Mike and I here are in my living room. Unprecedented. All right, enjoy the show. This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening Her, Nebraska, Zoolander, Invisible Woman, 12 Years a Slave, and more. On Wednesday, February 26th, The Folk and Folly and the Hunter play the E-Bar. And on Sunday, March 2nd, at 3 p.m., Anne McPherson celebrates the release of her novel, The Hedge, just hours before the E-Bar throws an Oscars party. The Bookshelf is an independently owned culture hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. Visit bookshelf.ca for more information.
Kids are on the skateboards in the parking garage, smoking right in front of the camera. Went down there an hour ago, but no one was around.
Friday night.
This is the first time I've done one of these in my living room.
How does it feel?
A little invasive. It feels like a slight imposition.
Who's invading whom?
No, I'm very comfortable, actually. I feel pretty good. I could probably even do one of these, lean back. This is actually very comfortable.
Yeah.
Normally, I'm in my office and we're on the phone, or sometimes I go and meet people. No one's really, only a couple of people have come to me, and then we've gone elsewhere. But I thought it's kind of a cool autumn day. You know, I thought you and I might sit in my backyard.
It would have been nice, but it's cold.
It's a little chilly. Yeah, it's a little chilly, so I thought I'd...
It's cold. I would almost go as far as to say too cold.
Well... And I don't want to be, we're old now, so we talk about the weather maybe more than we should, or maybe we're growing into that, but it has been weird, strange, like hot, humid, and then all of a sudden, I don't know what it's, it's like 15 degrees outside or something.
Yeah.
So it's no good. I mean, it's fine though. I mean, we're hardy dudes, but I just thought
it's cold in here, actually.
You find it cold in the house?
Yeah, but I have my jacket on, so I'm fine. But
yeah, we've been kind of slow on the furnace stuff. It's as I say, the weather's too weird. You never know when to turn it on. So
I hear you. I'm not. Yeah, I didn't mean it as a complaint.
No, it's, I didn't take it as
just
one.
It was just a fact.
It is a true fact. Sometimes I say true fact and I think of you. Did you coin that? One time you wrote to me and you said something to me and you said, oh, it's a true fact. And it just always sticks with me. And then anytime I use it now, I think of you.
I actually often, that's something I've thought about a lot in my life, actually. The truth of facts. Because for something to be a fact, it doesn't need to be true. Like, the sky is white.
Yeah, that's not true.
No, but it's a fact.
How is that a fact?
The format, it's presented as fact.
Wait, just because you dispensed
it? I mean, what
it?
Is truth? I'm just presenting you with a version of a thing.
Right, okay. You know, sometimes...
And I would describe that as a fact. I'm providing you with a fact. Maybe it's not true.
The thing about the sky is white is that sometimes the sky can be
white. Yeah, that was a terrible example.
Okay.
Seagulls are purple.
Right, right.
Although I'm sure there is some iridescent qualities.
Yeah, and I think if there's ever like a...
But you get my point.
If there's like a Welch's shipliner that has some kind of disaster...
Right, right, right.
There will probably be purple seagulls.
Right.
And that'll
juice
be awful.
Spill.
Yeah, if there's a juice spill,
yeah,
it'll be awful. I shouldn't even be joking about this. You never know what's possible in this day and age. You and I are both somewhat, I think we're, well, you in particular, because this should really be about you, but slightly cynical, observant. You are a very observant songwriter, an observant person.
Absorbent.
And
oh, observant, yes, yeah.
In the event of a Welch's juice spill, you would come in handy because of your absorbency. No, but it's hard to sometimes be living on the planet, I find, because there's so much bad stuff happening all the time.
Yeah.
And some of that comes through in your work, I think. Kind of like the human dynamic of just like persevering. Like, how do we get through everything? Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about how that comes through on your new record, which is comically and darkly titled Tambourine Deathbed.
Right. So can you just...
try to parse out a question?
Yeah, yeah. Make it a little more... specific, because I don't know where to begin.
I feel like, well, it's early, and you just had coffee. I know that.
And not even a full one.
Yeah. How is the coffee I made?
Great.
Maple-y. It's maple-y, yeah. I picked that up from Steve Albini. He showed me how to make coffee once, and I put maple syrup in people's coffee now. And
it's good.
Is it actually good?
It's really good.
You don't have to lie to me.
I'm not. It's a true fact. That coffee is really good.
My point is that you have, you sometimes convey... there's critical analysis within your work.
Uh-huh.
And when I hear this record, which is your first as Michael Fierstack since you've been Snail House for a long time, it's a fairly solitary affair. It seems darker in some ways than some of your other work. Maybe because it's not housed in as much of a pop framework,
right,
necessarily. It's more direct.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm getting at. Can you maybe talk about this shift in... What is it a shift in? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, actually, I would almost disagree. I think that the record is actually has a lot of joy in it and a lot of sort of like celebratory enthusiasm. And I think that what people are responding to as dark, because you're not the first, is actually just sort of a pensive quality and not as dark. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that it's not dark, and there's not a lot of dark humor on it and dark other things that aren't so humorous. but I think it's actually balanced with a lot more joy than some of my previous work. Musically, it might sound darker, but lyrically speaking, I think it's actually more balanced. It's more full spectrum. And to me, that's the change. That's what's happened with changing my name and sort of changing my sort of, I don't know, I guess for lack of a better word, persona or what, a public persona or
if
something.
If you take some of the songs sort of literally, like if I take a song like Leave Me Alone kind of literally after you've gone solo,
yeah,
that seems a little...
Yeah, but I mean, that song, for me, it's that's sort of like a duet between like a sort of a cantankerous male figure and a sweet, generous female figure. And it actually kind of ends up in a kind of comfortable place, I think.
Who plays the female figure?
Laurel Sprengelmeyer of Little Scream.
Little Scream, okay. Yeah.
She sings all those kind of backing vocals on the record and is the other part of that duet. So yeah, I mean, to me that's kind of like, I don't really like sort of talking about my lyrics in that way or getting into what they're about specifically. But to me, that's kind of how I read that song. If I was looking at that from the outside, that's kind of how I tried to put it out there. But I mean, definitely that figure is a dark figure, you know?
Okay. No, I mean, I guess my, all right, let's go. What about the actual musical approach to it?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that may also, now that you've discredited my thesis about your record, which is totally
Fair. I mean, your perception of it is totally valid. I'm just telling you what I think I thought I was trying to put out into the world.
Well, this is, it also follows two records where you may have been at least in terms of music, most accessible. I mean, there was some pop. You've always been really great at writing these pop songs, and people really admire you for them, and they're multi-layered. And I'm always, you know, I get these phrases of yours stuck in my head all the time, and I don't quite know how to shake them. And not that I've been trying. I'm in some kind of therapy for it. But you do have this ability to do that. And then this one, I don't think that that infectiousness is lost, because I'm still finding that mm-hmm. some of these things are stuck in my head, but also they're not housed in as those kind of packages, those pop packages.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious if, because I want to talk a little bit more about the obvious question about why you would change your moniker, and because that, whether you want to or not, that's a shift. But this is definitely a musical shift from the last couple of records.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is... It's definitely partially circumstantial. I decided to make a record at home. When I set out to make it, I had it in my head that I wanted to just kind of make a simple folk record and record it at home. And it's the first time I've recorded myself for a record, which is a hugely liberating and momentous thing for me.
What'd you do it? How'd you do it?
Just at home on a computer.
On the computer?
Know, in like a little office, you know. And I mean, some of the stuff, the drums, for example, we did at Jeremy's basement, Jeremy, who played drums on the record, and I didn't mix it myself, but just actually capturing all the performances was my job for the first time ever, and it was really fun. So, I mean, automatically, drums aren't going to be a big part of the record because I recorded it at home. So it just has this sort of folky aspect, but I think... maybe just as a function of trying to avoid it being hokey, you know, and at the same time as being folky, maybe it just ended up kind of dark in some weird way or something like that.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not trying to pretend that there wasn't some kind of like intention of tone or theme behind it, because there was, but yeah, I don't know. I don't hear it as like a dark record. I think it's weird. It's got a lot of weirdness on it, and it's pensive, and it has a dark side, but it also is balanced with a lot of levity.
Okay. You and I did an interview for Sentimental Gentleman, and I remember feeling that during the interview, during the conversation, I felt like I hadn't done my research well enough. And because I didn't really feel that at the time, actually. I didn't feel it while it was happening. I felt it after I listened to the record more. I'm like, oh, why didn't I ask about that? Why didn't I ask about this? And I feel like that may have happened again.
Well,
I may be ill-equipped for this.
Well, that's great.
Which is fine.
We can explore it together.
In retrospect, though, I feel like, how would you describe your relationship with like interview, this dynamic where people are trying to talk about your work? Because I feel like now that we're sitting here talking about it, I feel like often you've been like,
antagonistic.
No, not even disagreeable. Right, just like, you just clarify.
Right.
Or you're hearing things from people, and maybe it's just me because I haven't sat in on anyone else interviewing you. But you seem to be like, I don't know about that, which is fine.
Yeah. I'm probably overly obsessive about how I'm perceived. And so I see these as an opportunity to kind of clarify sometimes the sort of like, I don't necessarily disagree with how you perceive the record. I just think it's interesting for me to counter it with how I actually see it, and for to see what the difference is between those two things, and to see like how big that gap is. It's interesting. It doesn't upset me or anything like that. It's just, I don't know, but it's really fun for me to have an opportunity to actually talk a little bit about what I intended with the record.
Course.
Yeah. I don't know.
Why else would you want to do? I mean, I guess the optimal idea for some of these things is promotion. But
yeah.
For you,
sometimes, you just don't want to do this, but this is fun. So.
Yeah. When you say that you want to kind of address how you're perceived, is there a general perception of Michael Feuerstack and your past work?
I think so. Yeah. I don't know if there's a general one, but there are, lots of varying ways that people perceive me.
Sure, no, no.
Some of them are, they're probably all accurate to some extent, and I can't really control, all I can really control is how I present myself and what I put out into the world. But, I think in music, and particularly in music criticism, there's like a tendency to like just, things have to be categorized. I understand that. You can't walk into a record store and find what you're looking for without some kind of category. Like, you could put me in the folk section or the rock section or the indie rock section or whatever. But, it's like I sort of resent occasionally being put into like the cardigan wearing cat petting category of the record store, like under F in like cutesy music or whatever.
I didn't even know that was a section.
Yeah, huh. Well, it is. Yeah. Okay. And, that kind of thing. So, I think there is a lot of, so if you had come to me with that, I would have probably emphasized how dark my music is.
Yeah, exactly. I came the other way.
So for me, moderation is like where I always kind of end up thematically. And so if you're talking about how dark the record is, I think it's probably just my mildly antagonistic nature to focus on the levity.
I see.
And I think maybe we just landed on something here. Possibly a true fact about me.
I think that maybe antagonism is the right word. Or self-defense.
Yeah, maybe.
It's like a self-preservation thing because, that's interesting. Has anyone got you completely? Has anyone in this situation actually, like, have you been like, yeah, this is great. This is exactly...
I don't know. I don't think, generally speaking, at least I have the opportunity to talk like in depth about what I do.
Right.
And to talk for an hour or half an hour or whatever it is with somebody about my work or even their work or whatever. It just doesn't get to happen that often. So usually it's some kind of phone conversation asking me about why I changed my name and when I started the band and if I'm coming on tour to that town and what day and
kind
what,
of procedural.
And what can people expect from the show. And that kind of, those kind of interviews are pretty boring. And I generally, well, I don't get asked to do enough of them to feel like I need to temper the requests or anything.
I've been following your work for such a long time now, and I know that there's this is a fault of mine too. I kind of expect there to be, or maybe project an edginess to your work when there maybe isn't sometimes. And that may have happened with this record where I'm just like, well, it's Mike. I know Mike a little bit and I know his work and I know that there's probably a lot going on here that I haven't figured out yet.
Right.
And it's probably coming from a slightly, again, cynical sounds like such a negative word, but there is some cynicism within you as a writer, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably. So I think sometimes that's similar pigeonholing, just like similar, like this is what we're used to. And the last two records seemed on some songs in particular, like anomalies.
Right.
But at the same time, the more you got into them, you're like, oh no, this is actually just as it's dressed up pretty, but there's something sort of.
Well, I mean, I really love pop music and I like, strong melodies and I like, pleasing sounds. You know, like I don't think.
Yeah.
I don't like grating music, generally speaking. so I mean, but I like depth, and I want to make pop music that has depth. You know, and so, but I think on this new record, which is what I was talking about before, there's a couple of songs on there that are actually just kind of really hippie, kind of positive, like, hey, things are kind of beautiful at this moment or whatever. And I think that that's just as valid to write a song about and can be just as deep. And that's the one thing that I had never gotten to as a songwriter in the past, you know? So
what are some examples?
So that's, I guess that's what I'm talking about.
Sure.
As we started out this interview.
What are some
like
examples?
The song Trees, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, it's kind of like this love song, and it talks a lot about nature. It's like a pantheistic love song. and it's just, I don't know, I get kind of a kick out of it, but I don't think it lacks depth. Like, I think it's like, it's not uncomplicated, and as a love song, it's not like flowery or overly saccharine or anything. It's got sort of a sweet sadness that's just as profound as talking about how much people suck or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Or can has the potential to be just as profound, you know. So I mean, for me, like, seeking out a full spectrum of emotional experience as well as a full spectrum of musical, you know, like, there should be harsh, spiky elements in the music, and there should be a warmth as well. And so for me, like, balancing that entire spectrum is my, I think that's the new thing in
yeah.
what I do.
Okay.
Or that's what I'm going for in a way that's new.
You have, you've had this interesting trajectory as an artist that I don't know if a lot of people are aware of. And I kind of want to go back to, like, as you're speaking to me, as you were answering the last question and speaking to.
And at many other questions that weren't even asked.
But it did kind of bring to mind the idea that, you know, you've been on a kind of, oh man, it sounds awful. But I can see you coming to a point where all of the things you've done and all of the influences that have shaped you are now coming through almost, like, and have for some years. Because yeah.
You just did the thing you were asking about.
What?
If anybody ever, quote, air quotes, got me.
Oh, did I do it?
Yeah, totally. That's, because I know you're planning to ask me about why I changed my name and all that stuff, and you're hitting the nail on the head right now.
So
we can just shut this down and go have another coffee.
But I actually want to talk a little bit about...
Sorry, I cut you off.
No, it's fine. I do want to talk about your kind of origin story, because you, what I don't think many people know, although it's been kind of reported in more recent years, that you kind of come from hardcore punk.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you raised exactly?
In Moncton.
In Moncton, New Brunswick.
Well, I mean, you made that question harder to answer by adding exactly to it.
Oh, sorry.
But anyway, yeah, the era that you're talking about was in Moncton, New Brunswick.
What era was that?
Well, when I was, from about grade 3 until the middle of high school, or late high school.
Uh-huh. Okay, so grade 3 to middle of high school. When did you first get into music?
I was about 15, I guess. I was always into music, but that's when I joined my first band that did anything. I was 15.
So prior to 15, what kind of music were you sort of weaned on, if you will? Not that you may have been weaned on music. That's not nutritious.
Well, I think, I mean, I when I, as a younger, as an older child, but a younger teen, I was kind of, you know, I didn't have a lot of experience of like punk rock or anything, but I was really into The Police, and, you know, the things that were available to me were pretty limited. But I guess I remember The Police, and I also enjoyed a lot of like Top 40 radio stuff, like Tears for Fears, or, you know, that kind of thing. At the time, there was actually, like, you know, the top 10 we recorded onto our tape recorders and stuff. But
I used to do that.
Yeah.
Off the radio, I just would tape it all.
I think everyone of a certain vintage did that.
The first kind of file sharing, really.
Yeah.
Is that my son?
Yep.
Yeah, it's lunchtime now, so there might be a bit, just so people are aware, there may be a bit of a ruckus coming.
Bring the ruckus.
He's going to bring the ruckus.
But yeah, then my eyes were kind of opened when I got handed a couple of mixed tapes of various punk rock bands from a good friend's older sister, you know, pretty classic stuff. So, and then from there on out, it was just, that was my main musical interest for I guess, a number of years.
So you started playing punk rock around, did you say 15?
Yep.
And what was the band?
The Underdogs.
And who was in The Underdogs? That anyone we would know?
Rick White of Eric's Trip and Elevator to Hell was the only person that people would know now. He's the only one who's sort of active making records.
Okay.
But there were two other guys, Chris Forn and Dan Boudreau.
Okay.
And we made a couple of tapes. I would almost said albums, but we made tapes that were available and sort of became weirdly popular and cult, sort of a cult favorites to some people.
And you sang?
I sang only, yeah.
You only sang?
I didn't even really play an instrument at that time.
When did you start playing music?
Like playing an instrument?
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I always sort of thought I played guitar, but I wouldn't have actually been able to hold it together in a band or anything at that time. But then when my family moved away a couple of years later to a place where I had no friends,
and right.
I still wanted to make music. So that's when I started actually getting my act together.
Sorry, what's up? What's going on? You found your blue puck? Where was it? It was on top of the stairs? Okay, good. Good work. We've been looking for that blue puck a while. You got your hockey stick?
You found it.
Oh, he's been looking for that thing forever. Every time you lose something with a kid, it turns up. We yeah. actually were missing one of our phones, like our handsets for yeah. like a cordless phone. And my wife swore he'd thrown it in the garbage. I'm like, he doesn't really throw stuff in the garbage, though. And sure enough, it turned up on that couch you're sitting in, like months
which
and months later.
Which is not garbage.
No,
not
it's a
the
good, good
This
couch.
Is not the garbage.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not, but we're finding stuff all over the place. Anyway, so you start playing. So how long were you kind of immersed in sort of punk?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's just another kind of one of those categories that's hard to like.
You feel
it's
like
not. I mean, it's not irritating in any way. It's just sort of limiting. Like, I don't know how to. I don't know when that ended or started. You know?
I suppose the yeah.
Like,
no.
I mean, I was playing music like sort of like loud rock and roll music.
That's
where
what
I was
I
yelling.
Meant. That's what I meant.
For only about those years when at that time, and then we moved away, and then that's when I started making quieter music, just because, again, circumstantially, I was like in my bedroom at my parents' house and I didn't want them to hear me, and I didn't really know how to play, so I was learning to play through trying to write songs, which is what I always wanted to do.
Did you have teachers? Did you have guitar teachers or anything?
No, not
really.
Yeah,
you're a very gifted guitar player, if I might say. And
this
is all self-taught?
Yeah.
Wow. You just worked hard. How much time do you put in to do? When people hear self-taught, they, you know, there's no orthodoxy to it. They're
right.
just like, it's some slacker. Just, but how much time would you say you spent trying to teach yourself how to do these things?
Well, I mean, I wanted to write songs, and playing well enough to accompany yourself to sing a song is not necessarily the most challenging thing in the world. There's only like many years later that I started to even think of myself as an instrumentalist. But so, I mean, I don't know about like hours. I mean, it doesn't feel like work, and you certainly don't log the hours like when you're, you know, 17 and you don't have any friends and you just want to record a tape on your 4-track
or
whatever, you know? So I don't know. I really don't know how to answer that.
You just spend a lot of time. But like, I mean, were you doing other, you're not one of these people that, because some people, they just, that's all they did.
Right.
They just
no,
play
I
guitar.
Mean, but usually those people are sort of like, come out the gates as like strong instrumentalists, you know, like they're ripping guitar solos at the high school.
Exactly.
High school of talent show or whatever, you know, and that was not me
okay.
at all.
Did you play your, when did you, so you were playing sort of this louder, as you described it, you were yelling.
Yeah.
You were yelling for a period in public.
Yeah.
You play shows. There's YouTube evidence of some
yeah.
of these shows.
Yeah.
And at some point you started playing more quietly. When did you kind of emerge as a quiet...
In terms of performing?
Yeah.
I think I did a couple of things. Like I ended up playing... Well, I was still in touch with the Moncton community. Like Rick White and Julie Dwaron at that point I was in touch with them, and I used to visit Moncton pretty often because that's where my, the, you know, my closest friends were still living.
Sorry, from where?
You, from Ottawa.
You would move point. At some yeah. point. You moved to Ottawa.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, that was sort of middle of high school, and that was sort of the end of the, me being in that in the underdogs.
Okay, okay.
And so we did a lot of, you know, when I would visit Moncton, or they would sometimes come visit me, and you know, we'd all stay at my parents' house, and we'd set up the tape machine in the basement and sing on each other's songs. And that's kind of, that was a big learning time. So the only people I was really playing for were them. Like, we'd sing with each other and stuff. And then I guess a year or two later, I got kind of the courage to play at a couple of, I went to, actually we did sort of talent shows at high schools, not even my high school, just other high schools.
You just crashing other high schools?
Well, not even crashing, just, you know, I would know somebody and they'd be having some kind of, you know, event with people, not open mic exactly, but that type of thing.
Yeah.
And so I did a little bit of that. And my music, I think my music was always weird and probably very like poorly performed. And I don't think it was overwhelming for anyone, but there were always a few people who really responded to what I did and always found that encouraging. So, and that just slowly grew. And that's okay. What still happens today.
Right. And and at some point you were operating a snail house at that point?
Yeah, like that happened very, very early. Like the first, when I first started releasing tapes, I think I had like a releasing, you know, and when I say releasing, I mean like sending it in the mail to 25 friends.
That's
or,
fine.
Yeah.
You made tapes.
So there was one before I was called Snail House, which never really, you know, it only had a circulation of about 10 probably. And then I made one a year later that I called Snail House, the name Snail House just came from an inside joke with another friend, and it, you know, it was that kind of thing. I had made this music for just for my close friends, and so to call it to base the name didn't matter. It was nothing invested in it, you know. It was just, I'm going to call it this because he'll find that funny, and the other people might find it interesting. And then and so there were like three, like sort of full length album style tapes before I ever made a record or anything.
Okay. And did you, these tapes that you made, did you make them yourself?
Yeah.
Like on a...
I just dubbed them, you know, one by one, you know.
No, I meant literally recording them yourself as well. Did you make them on
On a four track.
On a four track.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oops. I'm destroying my living room. Yeah. Lampshade.
Just learning as you go. I mean, and that's what I'm doing again now, which is so fun. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And as I said earlier, when you said I got it, I feel like there's kind of a full circle aspect to this that mm-hmm. I'm slowly getting to. We're halfway around the circle, yeah. I think, now. But
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Eventually, you became friendly with people and you made a band called The Wooden Stars?
Yeah.
And this was at the same time that you had gotten quieter.
Yeah.
You decided to
get louder too.
You get louder at the same time, but a different kind of loud. Yeah. I mean, when I understand why you were deflecting my kind of punk question, because I kind of feel like in a lot of ways you're still a punk.
I mean, that's at the heart of what my frustration with talking about it in those terms. Like, you know, like I consider like Little Richard to be punk.
That's,
you know?
So do I.
And the Minutemen and Black Flag are definitely, you know, everyone says they're punk, and they were, you know, in a community together of sorts, but they don't sound anything like each other, and they're not really the same style of music.
No, not at all.
Whatever that means. So that's all. I mean, everybody who is into music knows those kinds of subtleties, but I find them difficult to.
No, but I mean,
difficult to talk.
You would argue you would. Okay, maybe punk is the wrong term. I just meant transitioning from out of hardcore music into what you were doing, a Snail House. Right. And then, I don't know, what can you say about what happened with the Wooden Stars? What was that?
Well, I was really, I was, you know, I was in a new city with, you know, as a teenager, it's a kind of a weird time in everyone's life, I think.
Yeah.
And I had some nice friends. It wasn't like a sad sack situation or anything, you know. I had some good friends, but I was really hungry for like-minded musical people and to just be really free in making music and do something really weird and not be trying to play like Jimi Hendrix or whatever, but just to do music that we found exciting and not be sort of limited by the idea of whether or not we were talented, you know?
Sure.
So, but anyway, so I saw Julian Bayard playing at another one of these crazy high school talent show style things or whatever. And I just totally fell in love with his musicality. It was amazing. And I'd never heard anything like that before, which is always the thing I've looked for in music. And he was not particularly friendly, but I was persistent and outgoing at the time. And we eventually kind of became friends, and then, well, we became bandmates, and then we became friends, I guess.
Oh, okay.
I ran into him sometime later, and he barely remembered me and said, like, oh, don't you play something? And I was like, yeah, I play guitar, man. And then he said, oh, because we're looking for a drummer. And I just lied and said I played the drums too. So at our first band together, I started playing the drums. But it didn't take very long for it to become clear that we should both be playing guitar and writing and singing together. So.
Oh, okay.
Huh. And that's where the Wooden Stars was born.
And the kind of...
Born. Hatched.
Just hatched onto the planet. This band gained a lot of renown. A lot of people love this band, but it sort of operated on a relatively small level.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you guys won a Juno, which was kind of... that seemed out of left field.
Yeah, it was.
And it somehow it dissipated. It just eventually slowed down.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sort of a grueling and brutal thing to do especially, you know, with the same group of people for, X amount of years. There's like a limit to how much you can do.
Right.
You get older and life gets in the way. But we did get back together later and make another record, which... Looking back now, I think kind of was more like unfinished business than anything. We had a lot of fragments and things that we wanted to see.
Yeah, wasn't it like 9 years later after initially working on it or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah, something.
I'm making up a number.
But it's funny, you know, I was talking about this last night with Tim Crabtree, who I'm on tour with, and we were talking about like the Rolling Stones and Pearl Jam, and everyone goes on about how it's amazing that these bands stay together for 20 years. I think it's actually pretty easy to stay together if you... have your own hotel room and you're only spending time together when you're making music, you know, like if you're fighting over who works the merch table and who loads the van, and you're sitting 12 hours a day in a van and sleeping on people's floors and rehearsing together and trying to make records and not having any money. And, you know, there's all the frictions and stresses that come along with all those things. Like, of course there's a limit to how long you can work. You know, it's just math, really.
Yeah, totally.
But I mean, I think it would be pretty easy. Like the Wooden Stars had been in that situation. There's definitely enough love between us and enough musical excitement that we could still be doing stuff. It's just that there's not the kind of response or like income generation that comes from playing those other bands.
I don't
get as much money as I do when I play with Pearl Jam, for example.
You were doing Snail House concurrent with... the Wood Stars, right?
Yeah, but it always was kind of a side project. It was always like the sort of, like my sort of intimate, like music that I didn't have to share the sort of creativity of it with other people. It was kind of a solitary thing. Not intimate so much as solitary, I guess, and where I got to sort of lead things.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, and I put out records. But yeah, it was always subordinate. It's much easier to be motivated to do things when there's other people working towards it too, you know. So I didn't do that much touring or anything at that time.
And so when the Wooden Stars kind of stopped, you kind of dove headlong into Snail House stuff, which makes sense. That's fine.
Yeah.
You, and I think this is true of the Wooden Stars too, and there's always a kind of infusion of humor in the work.
Yeah.
Whether it's live in banter or whether it's in the songs themselves.
Yeah.
Do you think that kind of approach gets shortchanged or is still short? I feel like it was shortchanged for a long time. Like you couldn't take people who weren't taking themselves seriously. You couldn't take them seriously.
Right, right.
Whether they, if they had a goofy photo press shot or something or whatever. What about you? Like, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think it's come around a certain way. I think there's definitely a part of my audience who like really loves that. And then there's other people who are probably a little disappointed to be sort of taken out of the mood of the songs or whatever if you crack a joke in between songs or something like that. But for me, it's not something that I've put a lot of like conscious thought into or anything. It's just, that's just my nature. Like I'm sort of a happy clownish guy. And so when I'm working, whether that's performing or recording or whatever, it makes its way into it. So I don't know. I mean, I do think that sometimes it kind of like spins people off in a direction where they're wondering if you're being serious or not. But I mean, I always sort of maintain that everything I do is like funny and not funny at the same time. And I think that that's most of the best works of art are kind of like that.
Yeah.
You can't listen to like a lot of Bob Dylan's lyrics without, if you listen hard enough, there's a lot of humor in there, or like, you know, Leonard Cohen, or, you know, there's all kinds of these people that people think of as like deep poets, and they are, but there's also like, they're also hilarious. And sometimes people, I can't even imagine driving around, you know, in my BMW listening to Leonard Cohen and not laughing my head off, you know, like it's just, it seems, at least occasionally, you know.
But do you think, but it's, is it also like humor in music, subtle humor?
I went off on a tangent.
No, sorry. No, you didn't. No, it's all totally good. But like that kind of thing is, you used the word, I think you used the word disruptive or distracting or something for the audience.
I don't know what word I use, but yeah, I know what you mean. Like they feel like they're being drawn out of the emotional intensity or something.
Yeah, but it's interesting because people find that those kinds of things so engaging as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, there's an equal, well, maybe not equal, there's a whole other group of people who find it really welcoming, and they, I think people are able to like appreciate the balance of like being able to laugh a little and then have a sort of a poignant moment or whatever.
Yeah,
laugh, cry, whatever, you know, the full experience. It's that full spectrum of experience like I was talking about, you know?
Yeah, I just sometimes wonder if it's,
I just
not...
think you just have to get, maybe for me, I just have to get good enough at it, at the balance, getting the balance right, so that,
no, I mean, my goodness,
find it entertaining, you know.
There's a line on your last album, and I'm probably going to misquote it, but it's something like who are all the dudes that you mentioned? Is it Picasso? No, it's Mozart, Debussy and Brahms, born at the right time, they would have all driven Trans Ams. That's
close enough. Yeah, yeah.
Who was the first one? Do you even remember?
Well, I just haven't sung that song in a really long time, and if you've ever seen me live, you know I have a forgetting problem.
Anyway, there's just like, that's a brilliant sort of
Tchaikovsky
and Mozart, Debussy and Brahms. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Born at the right time, they would have driven Trans Ams. That's brilliant. That's like such an amazing line, and I heard it, and when I first heard it, I'm like, I had to go back to it. Yeah. Like, did he just say that? And that's,
for me, the funniest part is saying Brahms, pronouncing it Brahms.
Yeah.
I think that's like the funniest joke.
Right.
But anyway.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know. That's just, so you kind of, I don't know. I don't even know what my point is, but I do think it's interesting that you're an artist that, because I'm kind of obsessed with this.
That's a dark song too. It's like a pretty sad song.
It is. But I am kind of obsessed recently with the kind of conflation of comedy and music that's been happening a lot.
Me too.
Do you have any take on it? Like this idea of, like, in particular, like in sort of like a physical manifestation, you're seeing a lot of comedians enter the realm of music, and that's been going on for a long time. Yeah. But more interestingly, musicians are entering the realm of comedy. What's your take on that? What is the relationship between these two expressions of trying to make people laugh and trying to engage them in song?
Yeah, I don't really know, but I've always been a big fan of the people who sort of do both really, really effortlessly. You know, like Jonathan Richman is an example of someone who is like that. But I think the two, like, those two things share a lot of similarities. Like they all have to do, they're all like performance based. Not all, I mean, you make records in both of them too, but there's a performance, and there's like a perfect recipe of like time management and timing and attention span. So like, you know, like rock or pop or folk songs or whatever tend to be around, you know, 3 to 5 minutes or whatever. And I think comedy is the same thing. There's like, you're on stage and you've got this like window and you have to balance it right. But you want to entertain people, and the best comedians are always a little bit heavy and a little bit pensive too, and the best musicians, there's a little bit of humor behind what they're doing, you know. I mean, even Kiss, you know, like that shit's hilarious.
Yeah, no, it is.
You know, and they know it's hilarious and they're having a great time doing it. I mean, I'm not even particularly a fan, but the point is that kind of it, I think it's the fact that it's a performance-based entertainment thing, and the traveling is very, it's like a similar lifestyle, like the sort of like, you know, one night stand place, you know, like you play one city one night and the next city the next night, you know, like, whereas if you're like, you know, in the ballet or something, you tend to go to a place for a week, and then, you know, it's like it's a very different type of performing art. So they have a kinship in that sense.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in terms of process, it's almost, there's microphones and PAs and spotlights and set times and set lists and all that kind
of
stuff,
and so all the practitioners have the same relationships to each other too, like they all kind of know each other and love each other, and there's all this like congratulating and back slapping, and then there's all kinds of like bitterness and
competition
and fighting and insane competition,
yeah,
you know, and comedians are famous for that. But it's like, I think like the two modes of expression are pretty tied, I think.
Well,
it seems natural that they'd, you know, they're both interested in each other.
Yeah, but there's also this like welling up of personal stuff that is being expressed.
Yeah.
It's all perspective, but it's all coming from a very personal place. And I just, that, it intrigues me.
But that's the other similarity. It's like you're a persona, and it's, a lot of it is you, but it's not exactly you.
Yeah.
And so unlike being in, you know, like a film or TV actor where you're definitely not you, or you're a classical musician where you're not expressing your, you know, you're expressing yourself through your instrument, but you're doing somebody else's score, or, you know, so many other art forms, even performance-based ones are so different, but those two are really similar. You're putting yourself on stage and you have to kind of act like yourself.
It's a heightened version of yourself.
Yeah, but you're not exactly yourself. You know? And there's a weird, difficult balance between how much of yourself you show and what's the right recipe for entertaining people and what's the right recipe for your own mental health.
Right. It's not quite kind of stuff. It's not quite theater or acting, but it is an amplification of some aspect of yourself.
And there's lots of improvisation in the at least in the good versions of of those things. So
yeah, they're really connected. It's interesting. And maybe, I mean, I've always been drawn to both, but I feel like there's been an explosion of interest in both recently, and whole festivals are taking over towns, and there's comedy stages at music festivals, and probably vice versa. I don't know about that as much, but I think it's true. Speaking of personas and figuring people out, you have gone from Snail House to Michael Fierstack.
Yeah.
And that marks a shift. Can you discuss this? Because I think we talked about it briefly when you said you were going to do it. And I said, oh. Because like in my, well, I just, because on one level, it's like, I don't know. I was just like, to be cynical or clinical even, you know, branding is important. But for you, maybe you were trying to shake off the association with Snail House? I don't know. What's your take on it?
I wasn't really trying to shake off anything. I think just, well, there's the really short, simple answer is that I was just tired of that name. I didn't like saying it anymore. I didn't like the sound of it. Like, I didn't hate it or anything. It was just didn't represent me. It felt, started feeling like, just I was just hanging on to it because I had always called myself that. It's like the worst kind of habit, you know? And so I just didn't want to anymore, and I didn't have any other names lined up, so I just started using my name. But also, it has to do with what you talked about earlier about wanting, like I've done, you know, I've had a long career so far of doing all kinds of different things, and I wanted people to be able to find, know who I am in relation to all of those things, as well as my own solo music. I don't want it to think, to be in some separate category, you know, like Snail House is this, and then he also does these things. I'd like for someone to be able to like look me up and find out everything I do, and so, and I think that in even more importantly, all of those things, like you said earlier, are starting to like appear in what I do as my solo music. So, everything I did in the Wooden Stars and playing in Bell Orchestra, the Luyas, or playing with Angela DeVoe, or producing records that I've done, anything that I've done like that, I think feeds what I do. And so I like having the opportunity to like make a change that makes people see it that way.
Yeah.
The other big thing is I felt that change was happening. Something was changing in the music or in my relationship to music. So I wanted to, you know, I made a really superficial change so that people could listen with new ears. They could, you know, the record comes, you know, your record, your inbox, you know, my record turns up in your inbox and you're like, instead of being like, oh, another Snail House record, like, how is this compared to the last one? Your starting point will be, oh, why is this different from what
psychologically it does a thing.
Yeah. And you know, I was talking about how I'm always worried about how I'm being perceived. Well, this is a way to sort of clean the slate.
Yeah.
And for me artistically too, like I don't really play the Snail House material now. When I do shows, it's all like I wrote a whole new set and a new album and I'm starting from zero again. Just creatively, that's like a really fun challenge. That's what I wanted to do. Huh. I'm not like rejecting that music. If somebody makes a request, I'll throw a song, you know, in the set or whatever. It's not a problem, but I'm not trying to turn my back on anything I've done before. But it was just personally a challenge to like have to create a whole new body of work.
Like comedians often do now. Often, you know, the best comedians now are like, I'm working on a set for a year. I record my special. Done.
Yeah.
You never hear me talk about that stuff again. So you are like a top tier comedian.
Basically.
So you basically is a great response to that pronouncement. Okay, well, that's remarkable. So you've got, I didn't realize to the extent to which, you know, on some level it's a nominal change.
Right.
I didn't realize it was such a like psychological shift for you. Because I didn't turn my back on, I'm not turning my back on it, but it does sound radical on some level.
Me it is, but I don't really expect the world to jump on board with that. Like, I don't think stylistically it's that different, and I don't think, you know, I'm still collaborating with a lot of the same people, and I'm still doing my thing, and, you know, I think you'd have to be pretty deeply interested in what I do to really pick up on those changes, which is why I wanted to do something radical on the outside to sort of signify.
Yeah.
Like, hey, people, maybe something's a little different now, or maybe not, who knows?
Okay.
And I mean, definitely there are people like who are starting to hear of me now who'd never heard of Snail House. I mean, you can become blind to something if you hear it enough and you haven't happened to have it, you know, explore, you know, if you heard the name Snail House 20 times in passing and you never thought to check it out, after a while you stop hearing it, you know? And so, I mean, that's more of like a cynical kind of business way of thinking about it, but there's also like a side to that I was, you know, it can be a little bit frustrating that like people aren't hearing what I'm doing because they think it's just some act that's been around forever.
Yeah, whatever, no, you know? I think
in my mind I've changed and done like, you know, new and exciting work every time I made a record, you know, and so
it's probably the wisest, freshest thing you could do. on some level. And
we'll see.
I'm glad you, because on some level you're right. You're hanging on. It's either hang on to something because it's been there forever, yeah, or depart. And you made a bold decision to do that. Have you figured out what you'll change your real name to yet? Like, if you had, do you have a list of options to change your name from Michael Fierstack to something else?
That's a good question. Oh man, this is a perfect time for a joke that's now gone.
What?
Well, there was that thing that I watched the Pearl Jam movie last night. you know, they had that name that they used.
What?
Doesn't matter.
No, I want to hear it. I don't know.
Yeah, but I don't know. I can't. We're going to waste a lot of time.
Okay, sorry.
I can't think of it.
There's a Pearl Jam, the Cameron Crowe Pearl Jam movie?
Yeah.
They talk about they had an old name and they changed it to Pearl Jam?
No, like they used like a fake name at some point.
Oh, okay. To play like a show or something?
Yeah.
Oh.
Doesn't matter.
No, that's...
But it was somebody's name.
Oh, somebody's actual name.
Yeah.
Okay. It just sounds vaguely familiar. I don't follow Pearl Jam.
Like a basketball player or something?
Maybe. Oh, that's right. Or was it Mookie Wilson?
Yes, it was.
The baseball player?
No.
No? Was it Mookie Wilson?
Well, no, I think it was
basketball?
Like, it wasn't a real, it was like a hybrid kind of a thing.
Okay.
It was like a joke.
I feel like I know this, and yeah. Someone listening is going to be yelling at us right now.
I'm yelling at myself.
Yeah, we're kind of yelling.
This is a crash and burn moment.
I feel like I know exactly what you're talking about. It's not Mookie Blaylock, is it?
Yes, yeah, it is.
Mookie Blaylock?
Yeah.
Okay. For real?
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Good, done.
But I might not run with that because I can't seem to remember it.
I don't have my phone. I took my phone away. I'll Google this.
Yeah,
after.
It's Mookie Blaylock.
I'll Yahoo it. I'm trying to change Google to Yahoo and no one's catching on. I try to say like, why don't you Yahoo it?
That's
and
weird.
No one likes it. No one says like, in fact, someone once said, I'll just use Google, which I thought was odd. Anyway. All right. Well, you've got the new record. You're happy with the new record. Everything. You made it yourself. Is this an approach you're going to take from here on in?
No, not necessarily, but it's definitely a great option.
Yeah.
Like I don't have a recording studio at home. I don't, you know, like per se, I can't do like any type of record I want. I can do a few different types of records that, you know, if I use my own home studio, but, you know, it's never going to replace like being in a big space with live musicians and all that kind of stuff. But definitely, I'm always recording now. Now that I've done this, it's like really opened the floodgates, and there's always something on the burner. I just finished a new record.
Of your own?
Kind of.
Oh.
It's an album that I've made of songs for other people to sing. So it's all guest vocalist. Singer-songer is the title.
Singer-songer.
Yes.
Okay.
And
so you're in the process of putting this record together, and you, I assume, asked a bunch of people to participate. Can you at least give us a sense of some of the people that you asked? I mean, you don't know what the final product's going to be.
Oh, yes, okay.
But can you just tell us some of the people that may be appearing on it?
Yes, I can. Angela DeVoe.
Uh-huh.
Leif Volbeck. Bri Webb. Jesse Stein. Devin Sproul. Laurel Sprengelmeyer,
Cyndi Lauper,
Matthias Kamm,
good man.
And there's one more.
Charlton Heston. Okay, that's
no,
amazing.
Not Charlton Heston.
That's a posthumous appearance.
That's so. I can't remember who I can remember them all. I just can't remember what I've already said.
Are you reaching for your defibrillator? What are you?
Yeah, my defibrillator.
No, that's amazing. That sounds like a great collection of people.
John K. Sampson.
That's great.
Of course, yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
These are all people that obviously respect your work and your writing. And are these so these are brand new songs you wrote for them?
They all said yes. Anyway. Yeah.
Are these brand new songs you wrote for them, or is it a historical?
Brand new, and I won't be singing them myself necessarily.
Ever.
No, I mean, it's not like a hard, you know, policy or anything. But like, there's a chance that, you know, I might fall in love with an alternate arrangement of one of these songs and put it on one of my records in the future or something. But no, the idea was to like write a song with that person in mind.
Nice.
And get them to sing it.
That's cool. That's great.
It's a good record. It's going to be cool.
That sounds nice. And did you do that mostly in your apartment?
Yeah. Jeremy played drums on it. So I went to the first step was I went to his house and played him the sketches and he played drums and we recorded it. Then I brought it home and did it there. And I have a few instrumental guests on it too, and then all the vocalists.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you're doing well.
I think so.
And you yourself, you're Michael Fierstack.
Yeah, I'm me now.
You're me now,
yeah,
finally.
Yeah.
Mike, it's great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you.
I'm glad we spent this time together doing this.
Me too.
I learned things that I didn't know, which is always
good. Me too.
No, you didn't. You didn't learn a thing.
Maybe.
You learned about syrup in your coffee.
Yeah, that's true.
If we were to go to a song from Tambourine Deathbed, could we do that? Could we play a song?
Yeah.
What song?
Let's do Leave Me Alone, just because we talked about it.
Okay.
And then people can apply everything we talked about to the listening experience.
To that.
Yeah.
Okay. Leave Me Alone, Michael Fierstack. Mike, yeah, always a pleasure.
Indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
I tell you everything I know. I give you all my money. All I ask is leave me alone. Leave me alone.
Warden, love your own self. Guilty behavior. Lock them out, lock you in.
Thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern, and you can listen to that online at CFRU.ca, or if you're in the KW region at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkana.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.